Okay, Wednesday, July 14th, meeting of the Board of Adjustment for the City of Shore Acres at 7:43. Will come to order. Who's present?
Carl Kraft.
Diane Victor.
Stephen Jones.
Stan Kraft. The first order of business is consideration and action to elect the chairman and vice chairman of the Board of Adjustment. Do I have any nomination?
I'd like to nominate Diane for chairman. I think Victor. Awesome.
Discussion. Will you accept Diane?
Yes. I'm honored.
Okay. Everybody for Diane Victor being chairman of the Board of Adjustment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Passed.
Thank you.
So, does she want to handle the next item then?
Yep, I guess the first hand over right then.
Which is the vice chairman. No, the election of the vice chair.
Second
thing on our agenda would be consideration of
action to elect the vice
chairman for the Board of
Adjustment. Do I have a nomination?
I nominate Carl.
I second
that.
Carl, would you
accept?
I accept.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Vote. Okay, we got a new
motion.
New chairman and vice chair.
My recommendation, Madam Chair, is that we go ahead and act on agenda item 2.2.
Okay, I wondered.
And that would clean it up.
Okay. The second item on our agenda is to grant or deny the request for variance to construct a house with 840 square feet area in zoning district C. Assisting that the minimum required is 1,400 square feet on lot 6 and 7, lot 5, Seagrove. And the requested applicant is Susan Holly. Do I have any recommendation?
Well, just to bring Steve up to date, Susan was here earlier. You know, she waited for quite some period of time. But towards the end, she admitted that she was kind of doing this with a hope and a prayer. She hadn't bought the land yet. She lost her builder and lost her financing because it was only good for a certain amount of time. So at least for right now, she's essentially giving up the situation. My personal opinion is that it's really untenable to build that small of a house in that area of the city, actually in any area of the city, because it wouldn't be fair to all the surrounding areas. So I recommend that we not issue the permission.
Do I have a second? Second. All in favor?
Just addition. There's information I'm interested in understanding.
Well,
we have a vote.
Yeah, you have a motion and a second, and you can have discussion and perhaps clarify any questions that you have. The motion that I have was to deny the variance.
So then I'm requesting a discussion.
Well, the discussion's automatic.
Okay.
And so, but I was just going to say from a procedural perspective, if the motion was withdrawn and remade in the affirmative to approve the variance, then we would not have an impasse on the vote. I don't know if you follow that logic or not. And so you know, Steve, there's five members of this board, and to approve a variance requires 4 out of 5 to vote in favor of it. To deny a variance, however, is kind of backwards. So, unless all 4 of you tonight would all have to vote in favor of approving the variance. happen. That, do you understand what I'm saying?
No.
Okay. You have to have a unanimous vote.
A unanimous vote for a...
To approve.
To approve.
Right. I'm not quite certain what the vote...
Of the four people here.
Of the four, right.
If there were five people here, then...
Okay. And to deny, what percentage?
Well, that's where I'm a little perplexed on a motion to deny.
That it may not even be valid.
Yeah, because it really would be a consideration to approve as opposed to deny.
Okay.
See what I'm saying? So, and the other part of that is that there's a motion and a second, and there would be discussion, and an individual member can vote yea or nay or abstain, but wouldn't be able to stop the vote from happening. And so...
If I made a motion to approve it,
yes.
There may not be even second if everybody else is...
That's possible. And even if there was a second, you're not required to vote in the affirmative.
Oh, once the votes...
After the discussion.
Oh, okay.
You see.
Okay, I see. All right. So I'm not committing myself.
Absolutely not.
Okay.
No, when I was on council in El Lago, the mayor required every motion to be made in the affirmative. So it was not confusing when someone voted for or against. Because it's a double negative. When you vote to deny and then you vote against, you're voting for. And it gets real confusing. So if all the motions are in the affirmative, then...
You don't ever have to wonder.
Yeah.
What
a yea or a nay is.
Okay, I'll rescind my motion to deny and change it to grant the request for the variance. If you want a discussion. We want a second so we can have a discussion so Steve can...
So as I consider this, I understand and appreciate not wanting or having a rule in place that keeps certain size homes for the purpose of property values, comps, things of that nature with neighbors. How many vacant lots do we have in this city? In this section, you know, if this became a slippery slope and we had and we set a precedent that said a bunch of 800 square foot homes would be built, they would be built on the empty lots. Is there a real risk here? And why I consider it is I consider the state of the city, the lack of sales, and there's a part of me that thinks any revitalization, of the city could be a positive. Not that I'm looking to go against rules that are in place, but I'm looking at it very holistically and wondering if there is any merit to allowing any fresh construction. You know? And if we did that, is there a real risk at plummeting values given where we are right now?
I would venture to say that that's beyond the scope of this particular body. I mean, that line of thinking would have to be something that would be have to be evidenced and made as an ordinance change by the city council for, say, a period of time or however they wanted to handle it. But for us to do it on a case-by-case basis, even the way an ordinance ought to be changed.
I see. So it would be more in the planning and zoning that such a consideration would occur.
Yeah.
If that was something to us.
Fair enough. Madam Chair, can I comment on two of those things?
Please do.
I have two background information things that you should know as a member of the board. And one is that decisions that the Board of Adjustments make don't set precedent.
Okay.
Every decision for variance is specific to the circumstances of that case. So, for example, if someone wants to build a 20-foot fence instead of an 8-foot fence, and they come here for a variance, and a variance is granted, that does not create any precedent for any other property to be able to do that.
Perfect.
Okay. The other half is that variances, when they are granted, the basis and variances, the Board of Adjustments is created under authority of the state, which outlines how many members, how the vote is, and what the purpose is, and it is a, this is a quasi-judicial group. So this is kind of half legislative, half court judicial decision. And so that authority that comes from the state supersedes the city council's authority. So when the Board of Adjustments grants a variance, the city council can't overturn that. It's final. And if the council wants to challenge it, they have to seek a writ of certiorari from the district court. And they don't have any better standing than the person who requested the variance and was granted or denied. So, and the only thing that can overturn it is an illegal act on the part of the Board of Adjustments. Even a mistake of fact won't overturn a decision of the Board of Adjustments. So it's pretty broad, awesome authority. However, the limiting side of that is that variances are for hardships. And court rulings have said specifically you can't consider financial. Financial is not a hardship. But the purpose of having variances for planning and zoning is that you have a structure of rules for land use, and that it anticipates that there will be on occasion a parcel of land in which those restrictions make it unusable for its intended purpose. So the easiest one to think of is setback lines. You know, we say that you have to be back 30 feet from the front property line and 5 feet minimum from the side, with the aggregate of the two sides being at least 15% or being at least 20% the width of the lot, and 5 feet on the back. And when you take all those in concert, you could have an odd-shaped lot where we have those restrictions and we have a minimum house size, and you can build a triangular house and still not be able to accommodate both of them. That then makes the land unusable for residential when it's zoned residential. That is the classic example of the hardship. Here's someone who's bought a piece of property to use to build a home, and the rules are such that they can't, and so they come and ask for a variance. And then the decision here is which one you grant the variance to. Let them build a triangular house that's smaller, or are you going to let them encroach on one of the, or a combination. And so that kind of decision. And that's one reason why they don't set a precedence, because if you say
it's very specific to
right circumstances. Correct. So for whatever value that discussion is, you touched on those two kinds of things.
No, and that gave clarity.
Okay.
And we've had people come in here want to get a variance for things like they want to build a fence that's not in concert with our ordinances, simply really for the reason that they can't afford to build that won't be our ordinance. And that's not a reason not to do it. You've got to find the money, or you don't have to have a fence. That's not required. I've had someone put up a cheap wire fence where everybody else could have a nice wooden fence or a metal fence of some kind. Didn't fit. Sometimes the job is a little tough.
Oh, I'm not always about that shit. It's actually looking rather quickly. So,
here's one thing on comps. Comps with real estate, if you ever pull up the MLS or anything, and you get on one of their sheets that show you the list of the houses, right? It's based on square footage and square footage, so those prices help us. The smaller the house, the higher dollar amount per square foot. Big houses are cheaper to build, and so they sell for actual per square footage price is less. So
I don't know how that would really, I thought about that while you were saying it. At first I thought, well, yeah, it hurts in the comps. And then I thought, wait a minute, small house costs more to build, it sells per square foot or more. Not that it's more, yeah. It's just, I mean, we all heard the adage, on the street, buy the smallest house in one of the worst shades, so you can do whatever with it, bring its value up. But, so I'm like, well, I still have to say, on this issue, I understand where you're coming from. Do we need to allow people to be able to build in here? I mean, we know we could use, any of us that are still living here, I don't know how long is this going to take, David, before, after the hurricane, people's property taxes went down. I've seen that in some of the HCAD comps.
Where are they taking it?
I'm talking about properties that were damaged. They went down drastically. What you said, and I believe I'm right, the year before the storm, our tax base was X for the city. The city had X to operate on. That it get taxed the citizens for, saying this was our operating costs. The year after, a lot of those people's property taxes, where their houses were damaged, whatever, they went down. Those of us living here had to pick up the slack. How long does that go on?
Well, there's not a real simple answer, but I'll try to convince you. The pre-ike value, post-ike value, the land values went up 5% post-ike. So property values went up in terms of land, lots. The structure values took a huge hit, and I don't recall what that exact number is, but the blended total, after you add the 5% back in, and it's blended because they can last before and after disproportionately affect your ratio. But blended result was that all the taxable property in the city of Short Acres went down 23%, which is just a massive hit for the city. That is, 97% of our operating budget is property tax. So that's how much the value went down. When properties are repaired from storm damage, and I have a whole split personality on this because you have to look at it from both perspectives. One is the homeowner, one is the city. And I have to keep the city hat on, but I have empathy for the homeowner side. So from the city's perspective, the good news is if it's storm damage and it's repaired, the property value can rebound right back up to whatever it is. With the only exception being is, we have certain caps on appraisals or appraisal caps. The appraisal caps are waived from that middle year of the damage. So if you had 100,000 and they've lowered it to 50 and there's a 10% appraisal cap, so then you're not stuck with the 55 being the maximum to go back to. It's actually 10% of the prior damage year. So if it was at 100 in that, you skip a year and then it can go to 110. So we rebound back, which is good for the city in putting us back. And it's really not, it actually leads you lower than if you went 10-10 on as a property owner. So you're a little below, but it just puts you back. We have what's called the Truth in Taxation Law, which has what's called the effective tax rate. And when the city collects taxes, it's this very elaborate formula that has been designed and then twisted, tanked each year that is intended to protect taxpayers from runaway property taxes. And so what it does is it requires the city to calculate a tax rate starting position by taking what was taxable last year, what was on the rolls last year, and then what's on the rolls, the same property that's on the rolls this year, at its new value, and adjust the tax rate down to generate the same dollars. So to put it in simple terms, if you had a $100,000 house this year and your taxes were $1 per hundred, and that $100,000 house reappraised now, and now I'm going to ignore the cap for demonstration purposes, but let's say it went to $200,000, then your tax rate, the city tax rate, would automatically be lowered to 50 cents. and that would be considered a zero tax increase. So if we went to 55 cents, that would be a 10% increase from your dollar because of that formula. Well, what they didn't anticipate is a jurisdiction-wide wholesale reduction of property values. So what happened to us in Shore Acres is citywide, our property values went down 23%, and it turned that whole formula upside down, where we were at 73 cents, it then pushed our tax rate to 98 cents as a zero tax increase, so that we recapture the same dollars, and then we move up from there. And what we did here is we actually lowered the taxes by 5%, so that we're down at 96 cents, 97 cents for this interim year. So those people who had actually took the loss because the property value went down, they're coming out pretty good. But there are other people who had minimal or no damage whose values didn't take a 23% plunge, and their tax rate just went up. The dollars paid went up to the city. It didn't affect the school district and all of those other taxes, with the school district being the largest. So it gets very, very complicated. And what we did here is, you know, the knee-jerk reaction is to say, well, the city has reserves. We'll buy down the tax rate. We'll use reserves and we'll lower the rate down. But the problem is that unlike appraisals, the city rate then would fall under the caps. And we would not be able, after the values came back, to raise the tax rate back up where it was. And we would be hobbling ourselves for years into the future of not getting back to where we were on revenue. And, of course, we have to operate the city, and people have expectation we'll operate the city and we'll provide services. So what we did was we used our reserves, and instead of buying down the taxes, we took the mean property value prior to the storm of $162,000, calculated what taxes you'd pay on $162,000, what taxes you'd pay with the new rate, how much extra you're paying, which was in the range of $340 a year more. Then we divided that number by 12, and we used our reserve to put Ike relief on the utility bills. And so you end up with $26.85 a month, thereabouts, on your utility bill that pays you back for the extra property tax that you're paying, so that when we get over this hump, your taxes go back where they should. We take that back off the utility bill. We're still going to burn about $300,000 of reserves. But we have complete control over the utility bill. We have very limited control over the taxes. So it lets us do that.
Well, then on that, okay, is our city better off not to just, you know, throw the baby out with the bathwater kind of thing, you know, but are we better off to allow a little more flexibility than in some of these guidelines?
I would take the position, and have taken the position, although it hasn't come before this body, that we ought to do just the opposite. Wherever possible, we should raise all of our standards that we have, and we have. We've passed ordinances and we've raised construction standards. We've created a storm surge district where we changed the type of construction and raised the standards, because what we have is forced urban renewal, if you will. We have a one-time opportunity to do an upgrade, if you will, citywide. Miramar is probably the best example. The property values on Miramar are below where they should be for the waterfront properties that they are. The reason they're so suppressed is that they were largely 60s vintage homes with the original owners or longtime owners who have not done updates. So those houses, while well maintained, were locked in time in, you know, 1965, 1970, and it kept the property values down. And when there was a vacant lot or an opportunity to build there, for example, the Kerber house, which was demolished by the family after the death of the Kerbers, their son demolished that house and put the lot up for sale. But what happens is when you have that one lot, is someone doesn't want to build a $3 million house between two $300,000 houses. You have the overbuilding. And so it was going to take us years and years and years through attrition of having houses that were bought for teardowns and then build. And then someone's not going to go all the way to the maximum level. They're going to go to the intermediate level until that becomes the low level. And then it was a very long process. Well, we lost 3 out of 4 houses on Miramar. And in that process, we did suffer what will be, I've estimated it take us 7 years to fully recover. But at the end of the 7th year, we turn the corner and we will be far ahead of where we would have been. At the 7 years, we start that trend to get us above. We'll be far ahead because we'll have new construction that's built to new standards and it are larger, more expensive homes, and that will pull up everything else. And so I think that while vacant lots seem to be a drag on the community, they actually are like money in the bank.
Yes.
They're like money in the bank because what we got rid of in that process by force, because a lot of people didn't want to get rid of anything, was undervalued properties for us. One of the things that the city did in this very avenue we're talking about was literally a week after the storm, we passed the city ordinance in here when we were still in wet carpet that changed our demolition requirements. It required that if you tore a house down, you had to take the slab out, the sidewalks to the house, you had to fill the slab to grade. Tore the garage down, you had to take the driveway out and the slab out and fill it to grade. Because, and that was really what you're saying right there, is to preserve property values, because 1 out of 7 houses here are being demolished. And the impact on property values of someone who comes into this community 3 years or 4 years after the storm and drives down the block and there's 3 slabs.
Yeah, they need to see a park.
It's low canal. You know, we had about 17% of the city was vacant lots pre-Ike. People didn't realize the number's that high. One of the reasons it is so high, again, is the nature of this community, is we had a lot of weekend houses and we had a lot of summer houses that were purchased back in the 40s and 50s, pre-manned spacecraft center, MSC, and the lots were really cheap. And someone would buy a lot to build their weekend place, and the lots were cheap enough, they bought 2 and 3 lots and didn't have anything on them, and they owned them. And so while we drive around and we think of it as part of their yard, they don't, they're fenced and they look like these people have a house on a big lot, but in reality they're sitting on 2 and 3 lots. And what's happening now is those are starting to get split up and being sold, and of course we'll always get more revenue off of 3 houses than 1 house on 3 lots. And so there was a perception that we were more built out than we really were in terms of the number of lots that are here and homes.
So how built out are we now?
Well, we've gone backwards. Yeah, I think now we're at like 27% vacant lots. And in some cases that may change. And again, I'll go to Miramar as a good example. 3430 Miramar and 110 Shortacres Boulevard, which was on Miramar, side by side in the circle, the 2 houses in the circle. One was wiped off completely. 3430 is completely destroyed by the storm. And 110 was demolished post-storm. The man at 3430 was going to rebuild, and his son purchased 110 Shortacres and tore it down and was going to build. They're going to build father and son side by side. And the father decided he wasn't going to rebuild, and he sold his son his lot. Now the son owns both lots, and now he's approached the city about replatting that into 3 lots. It is well-sized to accommodate 3 lots, and Planning and Zoning Commission will get to see that replat if he brings that paperwork in. But having 3 homes there on what are not unreasonable sized lots has long term much more beneficial to the city than 2 just giant houses. For the very thing you're saying, is that you, it's kind of like there's a base value in a house, and then the square footage adds just so much incrementally as you go. You never get to, I mean, you'd have to build just incredibly huge houses to get to the same value point for the city of having three medium-sized houses. So, this is, while it's painful, what we're going through, some of those forward-looking things that the city has done, and we have vacant lots now where you can't discern which one was vacant before the storm and which one was vacant after the storm, and that was the desired effect. And we are seeing now a bigger turnover of vacant lots, and people are buying lots to build new homes, people who weren't in the community before. And
so even with this port expansion, and are people just not envisioning 21?
You know, the port expansion.
You hear six, I'm like, four times the noise.
Yeah. You know, this is going to be interesting because 21 cranes will accommodate 7 ships. And I don't know if you've read the sound study they did. And I know
I did.
We're way off now, but the sound study that they did has what I perceive as some flaws. I'd like to argue with the acoustic engineers. It's not flawed from an engineering perspective. I believe it's flawed from a functional perspective, in that there are two threshold lines that they show on that. One's for 4 ships, and one's for 7 ships. And what they're saying is that the 7 ship line is the built-out noise, and the 4 ship line is the current state of affairs. And what they're actually trying to sell you is that for 7 ships, it will get quieter. Now, from an engineering perspective, here's what they're looking at. They line 7 ships up, and the ships have a height of 90 feet. And then you use the ships, in essence, become a sound shield for the movement of containers as they hit the trucks, and if they're loaded and unloaded. So in essence, they become a floating sound wall. But the reality is, the movement of containers will almost statistically never happen with 7 ships in line. Their model for 4 ships is based on what they have today, which requires them to have the 4 ships in the end, because they only have wharf space for 4 ships. When you have wharf space for 7 ships and you put 4 ships in, they're going to be every other. And guess what? Those 4 ships are going to make a lot more noise than the 4 ships we have today.
And that atmosphere sound is emanating from a broader, not just that you have those
vacancies. That's
vacancies,
right. That's
your
correct.
Source of sound is spread, and so they can't just extrapolate from their source point now, because you're going to have multiple
that's
source
right.
points.
With but that's, in fact, what that study said.
That's why I so quickly can tell you, well, wait a minute. Boom, boom, boom.
Exactly. Right. So it is blocked. However, going back to land use, it's what we call the freeway effect. Someone who has lived here or lived at the end of an airport or lived where there was no freeway, their quality of life is adversely impacted by those things, the change from turboprop jet aircraft or the expansion of a runway or the construction of a freeway. Someone who purchases after one of those actions has happened. It isn't just that they're used to it, but they have no compare and contrast.
Right.
They came in and looked at it with that noise here.
And then chose it.
They bought it with that noise here. They don't know any better. So it takes a community no less than 4 years for that to start to transition. So you end up with this deal where there's lots of studies and cases where you can see this with freeways and airports, where you have a drop in the property value as people who now are offended by the noise flee, and they drop their values to get out because it's their perception no one will buy their house.
This place sucks. No one else is going to like it.
Exactly.
Right.
But the person who does come in and buy it doesn't think it sucks. They're not coming here because they're getting a good deal because of the noise. They're just making a decision on purchasing a home, and it's either a good price or it's not a good price. And there's no stigma attached to them. And their interest is their property values going up, which is what everybody else's value was before. And so you then get this break over, and all that goes away. It takes time. You know, it doesn't happen quickly, but it does happen. And now with the hurricane, I think that's something we also will see happen at a much accelerated rate, because we have had a huge turnover in home ownership in the city. You know, we had a lot of retirees in the city. Our demographics are shifting drastically. We had a lot of retirees here who retired from what turned into JFC and stayed here and were happy and would have lived their lives out here. But, you know, in their 80s, they're not interested in the trying times of rebuilding a home. And so they sold it to someone else and moved on. And then we're not selling those houses to 70 and 80-year-olds. Particularly those houses, because those were, in essence, starter houses. Those were homes that people moved in here with families in there. There's a lot of four-bedroom houses for people who were young engineers and had families. And that's what's appealing to now. So we're seeing families move in, young families move in, and our age is dropping and dropping and dropping. And that's very positive long-term for the city, because, you know, they're... what could have happened to us, and there's only so much we can do to avoid it, is that that not happened, and the homes all turn into rentals in large numbers. And fortunately, knock on wood, and Jamaica, whatever I knock on, we've not seen that happen in any great scale. We've had, and it's funny because some people think it's real negative, we've had flippers come in. We've had people come in and buy 3, 4, 5 houses to flip. And I've had some people tell me how horrible that is. And I said, are you crazy? That's absolutely wonderful. Because they're going to sell those houses. You know, it's different than if somebody came in to do the absolute minimum and use them for rentals.
Right. That's what's on my street. I've got a lot of them.
Yeah. And, you know, and that's not
good.
It's
a different quality of life.
Yeah,
the police waste them, too.
Well, we're going to correct some of those rentals anyway, because, you know, people, they're afraid another storm will happen. We will have some of those rentals, even
sure.
Those properties they flipped because they couldn't sell.
Well, we've got some people in the city that have multiple rentals now,
yeah.
who live in the city.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, then, you know, it is also about, on that, I agree, rental property usually isn't, but if you as the landlord maintain a certain level of what you will accept, you can control that to a degree.
So hopefully if you're living in the city, you have the ability to better monitor the property.
Yes, you don't agree with being a slumlord, you'll, you know.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing that happens is eventually, if we do everything else right, those houses get priced out. This is a little different than a subdivision where all the homes are built in the same 24-month period. And they're all deteriorating at the same rate, and they're all in that condition. What we have here is a real mix, and post-storm we're going to have a greater mix. And that rental property that's only worth so much and only demands so much rent is going to get lower and lower and lower on that totem pole. And at some point, it's going to have more value selling it than renting it.
Right.
Or doing substantial upgrades, which
right.
most rentalers renting leaseowners don't want to do. They'd rather just sell.
Chairman, I'd like to call for the vote.
Can we have a vote to grant or deny a request for variance? Maybe to grant a request for variance to construct a house of 840 square feet.
Motions are made and seconded, so we just need to call for
it. Oh, okay. I call for the vote. Does it in favor? Does it pose? Okay. Pose it. Is there any other business we can take care of? Do I have a motion to adjourn?
I'll a motion to adjourn this
meeting.
Right.
meeting?